Thanks everybody for being here. My name is Sonam Sherpa. I'm a graduate student in the Soil and Crop Sciences section at Cornell University. And today I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about some work we're doing on predicting soil quality indicators by mid-infrared spectroscopy. Oops. So, soil health, we've heard a lot about soil health. A lot of the talks today have focused on how various soil and land management, crop management strategies influence soil quality and soil health. Today, my talk's going to be a little bit different. I'm going to focus more on some of the constraints that we face and some of the methods and approaches that we can use for effectively measuring soil health and other soil quality indicators across agroecosystems. So soil is highly variable, as many of you probably know. And what we see in many agricultural landscapes is that, the biophysical characteristics first kind of dictate the land use, the historic land use that we see. So this is a typical dairy site that we worked at in New York, where you can see that the maize alfalfa rotations are primarily in the low-lying flat areas of the valley, whereas on the higher slopes we primarily have land uses such as pasture and forest. And so this creates a very heterogeneous landscape with many different management units and then also a large amount of variation in some of the dynamic soil properties. So on the far right, we see a figure. We have a map of elevation across the site. And then land use here, we can see there's a lot of different fragments. There's a lot of different parcels with different land use types. And then finally, we have an interpolated map of soil carbon stocks across the farm. So there's a huge amount of variation across the site in soil carbon stocks. And as we heard from Fatma, soil carbon, active carbon, these are hugely important for soil quality. So clearly there's going to be a large amount of variation across this site. So how do we effectively sample all of these management units to understand how we can change our practices to improve soil quality? So what is mid-infrared spectroscopy? It's kind of, we're working here with the mid-infrared region of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's kind of convenient that many of the soil compounds, or the compounds that exist in soil, absorb light in this range. And so I've shown here I've labeled some of the peaks on a typical soil spectra. And so we can identify various chemical compounds and properties of the soil using this light fingerprint to tell things about the soil. So silicon-oxygen bonds, carbon-oxygen bonds, they have very strong spectral signatures, and these are related to various things associated with clays, layer silicates, various types of clay, the sand content of the soil, so very important properties. So applications. So as you know, soil wet chemistry can be a beast. There's a million different methods and a million different pieces of glasswares and techniques. There's a photo here of an old soil science lab from the 50s. I really like that from the USDA. What's great about MIR is that it provides rapid, safe, non-destructive measurements of soil properties. So we have this light fingerprint that tells us a ton of information about the soil, and then we can then use that to kind of look at the various or study the various properties of the soil. And so this technology was initially developed by some of the folks, or a lot of the pioneer work in terms of relating this technology to soil science was done in collaboration with the folks at NASA, where you want to be out on the moon, you want to be at Mars, and you want to be able to manage quantify the properties, the mineral properties of the soil or the mineralogy, but you can't take a ton of samples back to the lab over here on Earth. So they wanted to develop a technique that would allow them to very effectively use remote sensing techniques to quantify soil properties and mineralogical properties. So we have this method in the lab. We're using a benchtop spectrometer. And in the bottom, you can see some soil samples before they're about to be loaded into a spectrometer. So now, one of the real big challenges for this, though, is developing representative calibrations, or calibration models that can be applied over a large geographic region in a broad taxonomic grouping. So we want to be able to put as many unknown samples in there as possible and be able to get accurate predictions. We don't want to have 100 different models. So the real challenge is now figuring out what are the important characteristics in terms of geography, taxonomy, and other soil attributes that influence the spectral characteristics and therefore the quality of our predictions. So we've been doing this work in very close collaboration with the USDA NRCS Kellogg Soil Survey Laboratory. KSSL currently curates the world's largest soil characterization database and associated MIR spectral library. So people have been going all over this country for the last 100 years and taking tons and tons of soil samples, pedons to depth, and going and bringing it back to the lab and doing the full slew of characterization analyses on there so we can describe the soils. Now there's huge databases, hundreds of thousands of samples with a ton of data, a ton of different soil attribute data, and we're relating these MIR spectra. We're going back and we're retroactively scanning these archived samples so that we can try to relate this huge wealth of soil information to the spectral fingerprint, if you will. And so part of this project is developing, validating the MIR models representing a large geographic region in diverse soil taxonomic grouping. We want as few models as possible, as broad as models as possible. And then we want to evaluate these MIR predictions for 12 soil properties. So we kind of did a bit of a shotgun approach of soil quality indicators. And then finally, we wanted to compare the cost and precision of MIR predictions with traditional wet chemistry methods. So I guess I'm running quick on time here, huh? So just quickly over methods, this was a huge database that we used. We specifically pulled out only mollisol samples. They're very well represented in the database. They're hugely important in this country for agronomic practices, and they represent a very large area. So we had about 5,600 samples representing 26 states and 243 counties. So it wasn't just one sample from state. These were from each state. These were many samples collected throughout each state. And we had these various 12 soil properties measured for each sample, or most samples. So here, quick, it's just a predicted versus lab measured for the various soil properties, so you can quickly assess the quality of the fits. And what I've done here is I've circled the fits that have an R-squared greater than 0.9. And what we can see here is that the properties that tend to predict very well are the properties that we know have strong spectral signatures or strong spectral characteristics. Total carbon, many of those carbon-oxygen bonds that I showed in that earlier slide. So that's what we're picking up here. We're picking up the organic matter. Carbonate has a very strong spectral signature. The clay and sand components, the various silicates, those also have very strong spectral components. And so we can see we can predict them very well. But you might ask, how the heck can you have a spectral signature for water retention or cation exchange capacity? And if you look, cation exchange capacity is predicted extremely well, but how can it's a functional, operationally defined property, so how can it have its own spectral signature? And so to kind of address that question, we started looking at some of the correlations across properties. So we wanted to know, okay, if this property does not have any spectral signatures, known spectral signatures, how is it that we're then able to model it well using this technique? And so what we see is there are strong correlations across the properties that do have strong spectral signatures and these operationally defined properties. So if it predicts, if it has a very strong spectral signature and it predicts well and it has a strong correlation with one of those properties, it will predict well. So water holding capacity or water retention, cation exchange capacity, those are highly correlated with organic matter and texture, which both predict very well. So just real quickly, I want to show you some of the cost analyses. We're still just kind of in the mix of this, so this is just a sneak preview of it. But what we basically see is that over here we have the individual analyses for the cost, for each method, the lab method and the MIR, and then the relative cost. And then down here we have it for as we increase the number of analyses together. So carbon plus nitrogen plus calcium carbonate plus texture plus yada, yada, yada. So as you add more variables into your package, the cost comes up and the relative cost benefit increases. So basically what you can see as the sample size increases, we get a huge difference in the cost. So 25,000 versus
you know, a few hundred dollars for the MIR method compared to the full slew of analytical methods. And if you look here, that's a 91% reduction in costs from the MIR to the whole to the full soil analytical package. And if we think about, which we haven't got into this yet, the relative error associated with this method, it's going to be much less than 91%. So starting to tease apart the relative cost, relative error kind of dynamics is really the next step that we're going with this work. So just to quickly overview the key points, MIR accurately predicts multiple soil quality indicators. Soil properties with a strong spectral signature will result in the lowest relative errors. Correlations among soil properties allow for the prediction of variables with no direct spectral characteristics. A single MIR model can be successfully applied over a large geographic region in a diverse soil taxonomic grouping. Reduced soil analysis costs from MIR spectroscopy allows for better soil monitoring, promoting improved soil quality, reduce environmental pollution, and enhance global food security. So I really see a huge potential for this technology. There's going to be a big balance between quantity over quality. When we want to understand how processes and soil properties are varying across the landscape, we're really going to benefit for reducing the kind of analytical precision if we can get a huge bump in the sample size that we can, or the sample number we can include. And with that, I just want to thank NIFA, the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, for providing funding for this work. I'd also acknowledge some of my collaborators, Fung Nguyen, Rich Ferguson, Scarlett Bailey, and the USDA NRCS Kellogg Soil Survey Laboratory. Thank you, everybody. Yes, Jenny. You know, it's going to vary, right? So we know that cation exchange capacity is going to be a function of the organic matter and the texture. So what's interesting, you can't see it from this data, is this is from the PEDON database. And so the PEDON's sampling to 200 centimeters. So when we think about the influence of carbon on these properties, a lot of that strong weight is happening at the subsurface. Below 40 centimeters, we have very low carbon concentration. And so clay starts to have a much stronger impact and kind of shifts the weight that these given properties are having on the correlation, so the covariance structure. So I think a lot of that has to do with the depth samples or the depth of sampling and the range of values that are included in this data set. Welcome.
So is this the wave of the future, and who's using this so far?
Well, I think it is. NASA's using it. This Soil Survey Laboratory is World Agroforestry Unit. Folks at Cicero. So there's the three big groups who are really kind of leading the way, the Australians, the groups in Africa, and the NRCS. And they're all using compatible instrumentation with the idea that later we can join spectral libraries. And there's a lot of really cool work going on looking at mathematical techniques for reducing some of the instrument variation that, and being able to make spectra more compatible across instruments and labs. It doesn't do stuff that's not a very low concentration. So phosphorus, potassium, some of these properties that aren't directly correlated to anything that is there in a high concentration and is very small, so very low ppm. I can't remember what the number is, but I want to say if you generally have a less than a half a percent, it's not going to predict well. So if your max value, if you think about total nitrogen, we look at total nitrogen, total carbon and total nitrogen are highly correlated with each other, right? But we see total nitrogen generally predicts much, doesn't predict as well, and it's because the range of values is much smaller. You're measuring a much smaller signature.
Well, I have a question. What do you think about the use of MIR in field under variable soil moisture?
That's like the holy grail. How are we going to handle soil moisture? I have no idea. I would say kudos to you if you're attempting it. Do it when it's really, 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 really dry.
Yeah,